Welcome to What She Said. I'm your host, Candace Sampson. Well, it's the first show of 2024. So far, it seems we're off to a steady start, as of this recording anyway, so no major mishaps yet. So let's all take it slow and steady as we ease ourselves into the new year. January is Alzheimer Awareness Month in Canada, and today's show offers two distinct perspectives on Alzheimer's with some delightful content in between. Here's what's coming up. We open today's show with a crucial conversation about a form of dementia that's often overlooked, young onset dementia. Dr. Saskia Sivanathan, a leading figure in dementia research, joins me to shed light on this specific condition. Her work is pivotal in understanding how dementia can affect individuals at a younger age, challenging common perceptions about this disease. We'll explore the latest research, delve into the unique challenges faced by those with young onset dementia, and discuss strategies for risk reduction and management. Dr. Sivanathan's expertise offers invaluable insights into this lesser known aspect of dementia, providing hope and guidance for those affected and their families. Anne Brody is here with her first entertainment roundup of 2024. We chat about the emotionally intense All of Us Strangers, the true story of JoLo, not to be confused with J-Lo, in Man on the Run, and the heartwarming return of Son of a Critch. As we step into the new year, it's the perfect time to focus on self-care. Dr. Dasha Leniva, ND, in partnership with New Roots Herbal, joins me to explore the true meaning of self-care, practical strategies for integrating it into our daily routines, and the role of nutrition and supplements in supporting our well-being. Next, we take a look at a unique and vital role in the entertainment industry, onset therapy. Nadia George, an onset therapist, plays an essential role in supporting the mental well-being of cast and crew working with heavy or traumatic script material. We'll learn more together about this innovative profession and its growing importance. In our next Smile Spectrum segment with Dr. Mandeep Johal, we're talking about New Year's resolutions for dental health, and we're going far beyond brushing and flossing to explore how dental health ties into our overall well-being, cosmetic dentistry options, and even the impact of dental health on posture and gym routines. Finally, to wrap up today's show, I'm thrilled to introduce Michelle Wang, author of Oma's Bag. This touching book addresses Alzheimer's in a way that's accessible to both children and adults. It's a story of love, memory, and the bond between generations that I found personally incredibly moving, and I'm sure you will too. So whether you're looking for insights into health, entertainment, self-care, unique professions, dental health, or heartwarming stories, today's show has something for everyone. January is Alzheimer Awareness Month in Canada, a time to bring attention to a condition that affects so many lives. Recently, I was taken aback when I learned that a woman I went to elementary school with was diagnosed with early onset dementia. It's a stark reminder that dementia doesn't just affect the elderly. To help us understand more about this condition, we're joined by Dr. Saskia Sivanathan, a leading expert in dementia research. Today, we'll delve into the complexities of early onset dementia, its impact, and the latest advancements in research and care. Welcome back, Dr. Sivanathan.
Thank you for having me.
So for many of us, dementia is associated with older age. Can you explain what early onset dementia is and what age it typically begins to manifest?
Absolutely. So early onset dementia is actually the term that used to be used when we didn't understand fully how dementia progresses. The term's now changed to young onset dementia. And I'll tell you why. It's because we now understand that with dementia, there are sort of three stages. There's the early stage, the moderate stage, and then the later stage. And to differentiate from what is dementia that normally happens in older adults, we now call it young onset dementia for people who develop dementia before the age of 65. And with young onset dementia, there's between 2 to 8% of Canadians currently living with young onset. That's about 28,000 Canadians. But I would say that that's a pretty conservative estimate, mainly because we don't know very much about these Canadians. We know that they're not counted. For example, if you go to the Government of Canada's website, and look up dementia, you'll see a definition for young onset dementia, but no numbers, because we don't count these Canadians. We don't understand how they're managing in the health system. And generally, you're right, people think of dementia as something that happens when you're over the age of 65. But young onset dementia also can present very differently. So it's an umbrella term, again, that's used for anyone who develops dementia under the age of 65. But you can develop, there are people who do develop it in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and the symptoms are quite different. So I just want to touch on the umbrella term piece, because I've said this a lot. It's dementia is like saying cancer. There are a collection of many different diseases under that umbrella. And young onset is no different. With young onset dementia, there are more specific types that do present differently from people who develop dementia later. So frontal temporal dementia is a type of dementia that you tend to get younger, sort of more in your 50s versus maybe 65 and older. And the key takeaway is that the symptom that presents first is not always memory loss. With young onset dementia, the symptoms can be things like changes in vision, in balance, the inability to maybe do tasks that have been familiar in the past. Those are different from what you'd normally look for when someone has dementia. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is in the healthcare system, family doctors are usually not looking for this. It takes much longer to diagnose young onset dementia.
So can you discuss then the impact of young onset dementia, let me get that right now, on a person's life, particularly considering they may be in the midst of their career or raising a family? This has to really throw a curveball to people.
Huge, huge. And, you know, again, back to the point that we don't know enough about how to support people living with young onset dementia, because most of the support services available are geared for older adults. But you're absolutely right, Candace. So when people do develop or are diagnosed finally with young onset dementia, first of all, there's a delay. Sometimes it takes up to 4.5 years before they're diagnosed from the onset of symptoms, which is a huge issue, because the earlier you can get diagnosed, the more likely you are to be able to set up the systems and supports you need for yourself. If you're waiting 4.5 years to get this, imagine you're still working, you know, you've got financial commitments and responsibilities. Often people with young onset have younger children that they're caring for as well, and might have older adults in their lives that they're also caring for. So it's a very, very different need. In fact, it's so different that there is a whole organization that's been set up in Calgary called UQuest. And it's designed specifically for people who are living with young onset dementia, just because their needs are very different from the kinds of services that are offered for older adults.
Are there specific risk factors or causes that are associated with young onset dementia?
So there's definitely a genetic component partially associated with young onset dementia, but let me differentiate. If you develop young onset dementia, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have the genes that could pass on dementia. However, if you have a genetic component, you're more likely to develop dementia younger. I hope that makes sense. When you look at it, there are a couple of genes that are involved with developing dementia, and that tends to be that you develop the dementia younger or before the age of 65, sometimes as early as your 30s. But no, for the most part, there's very little understood about how dementia and young onset dementia may be different in terms of its risk factors from people developing dementia over the age of 65. Another really interesting point is, does this have a difference in terms of men versus women? When we know that dementia impacts women generally more than men. And when I looked at the literature more recently, there's no conclusive evidence. There's trends that indicate that women are more likely to develop young onset dementia than men. And that's interesting, because it also means that there are certain risk factors and probably biological factors related to being female that increase your risk versus being male. But again, not very much understood about the disease at all.
And going back to sort of that umbrella term then, you know, as you compared it to, say, cancer, where, you know, certain types of cancer are highly treatable, there we have great, you know, treatments for it. Does that apply here in any way? Is there hope, more hope, I guess, maybe for young onset dementia?
Well, I mean, young onset dementia does progress in very much a similar way to if you develop dementia later on in life. With some kinds of dementias, especially young onset, it can be fairly aggressive. And so people can progress within 2 to 3 years, which is very rapid. But there are those who live well with dementia for up to 20 years. In fact, one of my close friends, Roger Marple, developed dementia when he was 58, so young onset dementia, lived well with it, but then did develop lung cancer later on, and he passed away last year, actually. And so, you know, I think there are ways to be able to live well with it, but the problem is that the supports aren't really there. And I don't know if you've been following the news, but there, Lisa Raitt, a former MPP whose husband has young onset dementia, and you really hear about the struggles she has because the supports aren't geared for him. Even the kinds of living arrangements that are available having someone come into the home to care for him were different and just didn't meet her needs and his needs.
So what is available then in terms of resources and help for people dealing or struggling with this right now?
Well, I think the first is that even though you might develop young onset dementia, doesn't mean that you can't access the services that are available regardless, whether you're old or adult or not. But the other is that there are caregiving benefits that you can access. And again, with a lot of the therapeutics that are starting to come to the market, the most important aspect of it is that getting a diagnosis early is important. Because the earlier in your disease that you're able to get the diagnosis, the more likely those therapies could be effective. And then just setting up that system for yourself, talking to your employer and helping them understand what you're going through, getting those supports in place. And again, you're protected under employment rights around this. So these are the sorts of things right now that you could access in terms of supports and therapies.
All right, Saskia, thank you so much for joining me today. You know, we did an interview earlier in December. I encourage people to go to the podcast and listen to that one as well. But this is very informative and very helpful. So thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
CareToKnow.ca is a free resource where Canadians receive the latest health information, updates on new and existing treatments, and advice from Canadian doctors via email. After enrolling at CareToKnow.ca, you'll receive accurate and reliable information from trusted Canadian medical experts delivered directly to your inbox. Members can also access the website for information on a variety of health-related topics. Through resources like vodcasts, podcasts, and live webinars, Canadian experts discuss how to manage a number of medical conditions and provide the latest knowledge and advice to help you make informed decisions about your family's health with your own healthcare provider. To sign up and start learning more about the health matters that impact you most, enroll in CareToKnow.ca today.
Have you ever thought, I'd love to have a podcast just like this one? Well, I can help. My name is Matt Kundle, and everyone at my company, the Sound Off Podcast Network, had a hand in making this show. Whether it was about the sound, the discoverability, or that you're just enjoying the show, we are all about the detail. If you think you have a podcast in you, reach out to me via email, matt@soundoff.network, or check out the website and become one of the great podcasts we work with at soundoff.network.
It's a new year, and Anne is in with a whole lot of new shows and entertainment for us. Anne, I can't wait to get into today's lineup. Can we start with All of Us Strangers? That I was gutted just watching the trailer.
It is such an experience. Oh, it is painfully beautiful. I don't think I've ever described a film that way, but yes. So it's Andrew Haig's fantasy drama starring Andrew Scott, who is a fantastic British actor. So he plays Adam, and he's a script writer. He lives in London, and nothing's going on in his life, and he's being very introverted. But he meets a man who lives in his building, and they have sex almost immediately. And then it cuts immediately to him walking as an adult down the street where he grew up and into his home, and his parents are there looking like they looked when he was little. And they look at him as though he's little, and he's caught up in that scenario. And it's very moving for him. It's just, and the way the film is made, it just gets under your skin so much. So they had died in a car crash. And I think the idea of this is these fantasies help relieve the trauma for him. But the affair is, I don't think it really blows him away, because he's so obsessed with these parents. He goes back time and time again to visit them and to find out, and to just, and his longing for them is just, oh, heartbreaking. It's amazing.
Well, I have to tell you, I watched the trailer and I got very choked up. Yeah. a two minute trailer. And then I read your review, and you ended it with, "You will need recovery time." And I laughed out loud, because if I was that emotional from a trailer, I can't imagine what a movie would do. But I am looking forward to this one. Let's talk about Man on the Run. Totally different story altogether, but fascinating.
Oh, yeah. There's this guy named Low-Tech Joe, who is known as Joe Low, and he is a billionaire from Malaysia. And what a con artist he is. All right. He's on the run. He's been on the run for years. Nobody knows where he is. Last time he was seen was in the Arctic Circle, of all places. So what he did, the Malaysian government, run by this corrupt prime minister who held two terms, and he's in jail right now for this, for this deal he made with Jolo. So they opened up a fund based on borrowed money to present as the backup for the country. Well, that never happened. It was all stolen, mostly by this guy. But he carried out these scams all around the world, and he had Hollywood at his beck and call. I mean, he was big friends with DiCaprio, Spears, Kardashian, Bradley Cooper, Robert De Niro, Kanye West. And he even funded the film Wolf of Wall Street, which was about greed. So the numbers in this thing, the amount of money, I mean, it's stunning. He talks about one theft alone that was $910 billion. I mean, is there that much money in the world?
It's so abstract to us commoners to talk about this kind of money. You can't wrap your head around it. But true story, and the guy's still on the run.
He's still on the run. The PM is now in his second jail term, and not a single Hollywood star that was quite tied in with him consented to sit down for an interview. P.S., he paid them to spend time with him.
Wow. Tell you, you can have all the money in the world and still be very lonely, apparently. So there you go. All right, let's talk about Son of a Critch and Run the Burbs, because...
Right, but I want to stop you. You've never heard of this. How can that be?
I've never. And here's what I also learned from you prior to starting this interview. I mentioned that I don't have CBC Gem. I thought I'd had to pay for it. You say it's free. So we could just... I had no idea. I'm just, I don't know how the TV works anymore, apparently. with the fall of cable and sort of all of these streaming services, I just automatically assume I have to pay for every single service. So I just...
No, it's the government. You're paying for it already with your taxes.
Well, perfect, because I'm going to download it.
I challenge you to go back there and to watch all three seasons of Son of a Critch, because starring Mark Critch, it's his memoirs, and it's got these brilliant actors in it, unbelievably including Malcolm McDowell as Grandpa.
I saw that.
And I interviewed them, and I asked the boys if they had seen Clockwork Orange. And one of them had, and the other is not allowed. But anyway, you are going to go crazy for Son of a Critch.
Well, it looked like a lovely trip down memory lane, watching just the trailer for that third season. So I am absolutely going to do that. And just quickly, tell me about Run the Burbs.
Well, you know, they're back for another season, Andrew Fung and Rakim Muzaria. And they're these suburban parents. They don't hate suburbia like everyone seems to. They live sort of a normal life, but it's anything but normal because it's real life. And you know how that goes. So, I mean, they have a garage sale and it's fun and they get into things with the neighbors. And then somebody sells off her cookbook, which was her mother's cookbook, and it was precious to her. Things like that happen, just little things. And then they can't find a doctor, a family doctor, which is a common situation. There's much to relate to here, and it's so funny. And they are such slackers. Remember the slackers from years ago? And they're slash valley people. And I think you'll get a big kick out of that too. And that's free on CBC Gem as well.
Perfect. Well, I like free. That is one of my favorite F words. So I'm going to chase that down this week. Anne, thanks so much. You've got all of these and more on whatshesaidtalk.com. And we will see you next week.
We'll see you next week.
As we step into the new year, it's the perfect time to reflect on our well-being and consider how we can prioritize ourselves in the months ahead. Joining me now is Dr. Dasha Leniva, ND, as part of What She Said's continuing partnership with New Roots Herbal. In this conversation, we'll explore what it truly means to prioritize self-care, how to recognize the need for a personal reset, and practical strategies for integrating self-care into our daily routines. We'll also delve into the role of nutrition and supplements in supporting our self-care journey. Welcome to What She Said, Dasha.
Thank you for having me. It's so great to be here.
So what does it mean to put yourself first or to prioritize your own well-being?
Well, first of all, it's recognizing that prioritizing yourself isn't something that we should view as selfish. We often think of it as a bad word, but it's really not. You know, the bad word here is selfless. If we say we are selfless, we're basically saying that we don't consider ourselves at all. And reframing it in this way kind of makes you feel a little bit different about the word, doesn't it?
Right.
If we don't, at the very least, keep our basic health needs like sleep, exercise, and diet dialed in, we are inherently setting ourselves up for a bad time. And on top of that, if we put everyone else above ourselves, and let's be real, women do this a lot, we drain our own mental, emotional, physical cups and leave ourselves with essentially nothing. So that was a roundabout way of saying that putting yourself first means, number one, making sure that you have your basic needs met, and two, listening to whatever else your body needs. Ignoring our needs is only going to make them fight stronger to be heard.
Well, let's talk about those needs, because especially now that we're in January, we're past the sort of the hustle and bustle and massive stress that December brings. So what are the signs or cues we should be looking for that signal that need for a reset?
Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of a hard question because, you know, everyone is different, but some of the signs that you could look out for are anxiety, low mood, stress, and especially feelings of overwhelm and difficulty concentrating, fatigue. So these are all clues that you might need a little bit extra support. And, you know, look, I understand that it's easy to ignore these things and say, oh, well, maybe I'm just tired. Maybe this is my normal. And yes, if you got a bad night's sleep the night before, it is normal to be tired, but being tired all the time, being overwhelmed and anxious all the time really isn't normal. And that goes for all the other signs that I mentioned earlier too.
What are some effective self-care practices then for enhancing our mental, emotional, and physical well-being?
So as I mentioned earlier, getting the pillars of health dialed in is key. So making sure you're getting adequate sleep, you're eating good and nourishing food, and enough of it. That's something I see a lot, is people don't actually eat enough food, even though their diet is good. And making sure that you're exercising regularly. So in addition to improving how we eat, obtaining regular sleep, and being more active. So while this may seem rather obvious, I believe that many people need to actively pursue fun as a way to improve their overall lifestyle and well-being. So fun is vastly overrated. And often results in less emotionality, better self-esteem, and enhanced social connectedness. Other things you can incorporate as well would be things like meditation, and this can be active meditation, like yoga or doing breath work. Journaling is wonderful too. Learning something new every day or doing something that brings you joy.
I really, really love that you mentioned bringing fun into your life, because I think we do. We chase sleep and we chase meditation, and we're so diligent and hardcore on chasing our goals this, you know, in the new year, and we forget to have fun, to just relax and enjoy it. So that's such a great point. And how about integrating nutrition and supplements into our life? Any suggestions there, especially for people who maybe haven't been doing so, maybe as much as they should have?
So that's a great question. So what supplements really do is fill any nutritional gaps that we may have and support ourselves in certain aspects that we need it most. For example, if we're stressed, we have adaptogens like rhodiola and ashwagandha in our toolkit. If we're anxious, something like lavender is a great option too, super helpful for sleep as well. And lots of research on those supplements. And then there are the supplements that, in my opinion, everyone should talk to their doctor about being on. These are things like omega-3s, which basically help support everything from mood, cardiovascular function, brain health. There's vitamin D, which is super important for immune function, mood, and bone health. And living in Canada, most of the population is chronically vitamin D deficient. So it's really important to get your levels checked. And as I mentioned earlier, filling those nutritional gaps is important. And that's why a high quality multivitamin might be beneficial, with lots of B vitamins for energy and metabolic support. But before we do any of that, we need to get diet in order. So we need to ensure that we're eating enough protein, healthy fats, and carbohydrates. And I promise you, carbohydrates are not evil. And having the proper nutrition that actually supports our body's function helps energy, mood, and overall health. And, you know, these changes aren't that hard. They basically just require you to eat real food and enough food.
And what strategies or methods do you suggest for maintaining a routine, which I think is what people struggle with the most?
Yeah, that's always really tough. But what I say to my patients is, first, you got to meet yourself where you're at. You don't expect changes to appear overnight. And the things that actually stick aren't the things that happen super quickly. You can't make changes like that. You know, first of all, you need to figure out what your priorities are and then start making small attainable strides towards them. If you're struggling to kind of figure out what that means and how to do it, I'd recommend reading Atomic Habits by James Clear. He really lays down that framework beautifully. But if you don't want to read his book, the gist of it is, figure out what you want, make things easy for yourself, and make those changes habits that you do every day. Another thing that's really powerful is to set clear times for set care, so you don't all of a sudden feel overwhelmed to fit in exercise or time to meal prep. And if you make time in advance, you'll never have no time to do something. And the last thing is, don't forget to be kind to yourself. The goal isn't to be perfect. The goal is to do things that make us feel good. And it's not the end of the world if you slip up on one of the habits that you're trying to make. The difference is getting back into it the day after and learning how to fail without labeling yourself as a failure.
Oh, I love it. Perfect. That's great. Thank you, Dasha, so much for joining me today. If people want to connect with you, where can they find you?
If you're in British Columbia, you can come see me at the clinic at Yale Town Integrative Clinic. I do appointments virtually or in person, and I'm on Instagram at dr.dashalaneva.
All right, wonderful. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Hello, I'm Wendy Mesley.
There you are. A lot of people have wondered what happened to you.
I could say the same about you, Maureen Holloway.
Well, here we are, a few years after we left our previous jobs. We've been busy.
We have a podcast. I know, you're thinking, who doesn't? But ours is really good. It's called Women of Ill Repute.
We don't just talk to women, though. Just the most interesting people you'd ever want to meet.
Artists, musicians, comedians, doctors.
Activists, convicts, writers, sex workers.
Drop some names.
Jan Arden, Pamela Anderson, Bruce Coburn.
Samantha Irby, Louise Penny, Marilyn Dennis, Colin Mochrie.
We laugh, we cry, sometimes we argue. Come and find us.
Our website is womenofillrepute.com.
Or try Apple, Spotify, and all the podcast places.
So now you know what happened to us. Women of Ill Repute.
Hi, I'm Steve Yerko.
And I'm Tara Sands. Now available from Maji Media is our new podcast, 4Kids Flashback. 4Kids is the company who brought you the English dub of Pokemon in the late 90s and so many other shows like Yu-Gi-Oh!, Shaman King, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Kirby, the infamous One Piece dub, and so many more.
We'll be talking to the people who worked at 4Kids. Actors, directors, writers, editors, producers, engineers, you get the point. And hopefully get the answers to questions both you and I have about the company.
I actually worked there as a voice actor on some of the shows.
And I was a kid watching the shows and remember way more than Tara does.
And thank God for that. Steve is actually a professional storyboard artist, which gives some really unique insights into anime and animation. Subscribe today wherever you get your podcasts. That's the number 4Kids Flashback.
My favorite things about hosting What She Said is learning about all the incredibly fascinating and unique jobs there are out there. Today, we're shining a spotlight on a crucial role in the entertainment world, on-set therapy. Joining me is Nadia George, an on-set therapist who plays a vital role in supporting film and television cast and crew as they navigate the emotional challenges of working with heavy or traumatic script material. With only a handful of professionals like her in Canada, Nadia's work is not just innovative, but also essential for maintaining mental well-being in the industry. So let's learn more about this intriguing profession and why mental health support on set is increasingly important. Welcome to What She Said, Nadia.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to have this chat.
I had never heard of this type of work before. So can you start by explaining what on-set therapy is and how you became involved in this field?
Yeah, on-set therapy essentially is just making sure that there's some form of certified wellness coach that's on-site that is available to both cast and crew and production team members to be able to talk through scenes or things that have happened on set that may be triggering or shocking. It is something that's very new. The UK, in fact, is doing it very well. But in Canada, we are only just starting to recognize that this is a need. Much like intimacy coordinators, it's really about the safety and protection of the well-being of people on set.
And what are some of the common challenges or issues that cast and crew face on set?
I think one of the bigger things we're starting to notice is that even though as, you know, a cast member, we go through rigorous acting training, most of us, and we think that we are prepared to be able to separate ourselves from the role or the character that we are embracing and coming home and leaving that where it is. The problem that we're finding for some people, and I'll speak for myself, it's also as an actor, that Your body, when you are taking on these roles, you're really trying to find the truth and living in it. So most acting coaches, or the ones I've experienced, will say, you know, where has this happened to you before? Have you experienced it? Do you know someone who has? And we know that somatically our bodies don't recognize that it isn't real. And so our bodies will hold on to those things, even though our minds are saying it's okay, it's just a scene, it's just a movie, which can sometimes take us away from giving the best quality performance that we want to. And it can also then have a, you know, domino effect into our actual daily lives with our spouses and our friends and those kinds of things. For crew members, what I found in my experience, especially with being on the show Little Bird doing this role, was a lot of them had sometimes not heard of or seen some of the content that was being played out in those scenes. And for them, knowing that this was real, that historically these things had happened to people, was really shocking for them. And they're also trying to process feelings of guilt, shame, sometimes triggering events that actually might have happened to them that were very similar. And you don't recognize the impact that that can have until it happens to you. So for me as an onset therapist, I think the role being able to support and letting people know that there is at least a safe space if they want to go talk to someone it alleviates it just a little bit because you know it's there if you need it versus trying to figure it out on your own.
And obviously this differs from traditional therapy, even just the setting is different. So does the therapy differ in some way?
I would say yes. And the reason for that and how I got involved really was that the production team of Little Bird had reached out to me and had said, you know, we really would love someone who one has lived experience in kind of the content, which I do coming from, you know, having child welfare experience, and also the idea of being an actor. Because one of the main things is you sometimes need to be in the role. And as a therapist, we sometimes are like, oh my goodness, that person is crying, or I can see they're really upset, and we can pull actors out of what they need to be in. So being able to recognize when they're in the moment, when they're in the character and in the scene, versus when the after effects are happening, if they should happen, and also knowing where to be on set, when to be on set, when do you approach an actor, those kinds of things really do make a difference. And it can either cost or save a production company a lot of money.
You mentioned something interesting there. You said, you know, when do you approach an actor? So this isn't always on them. It's oftentimes you approaching them.
Yeah, I think it's a shared relationship as you get to know the actors and you start to build rapport, much like you would in a therapy session with, you know, a client or an individual who needs support, is that you start to read the body language. You really get to know them. And just even a simple check-in of, hey, I know this is a really hard scene coming up. I just want to let you know I'm here. Okay, great. And most of the time I found that they were pretty good at saying, nope, you know what? I'm just going to stay in it. I'm good. No problem. You back away. And sometimes they do come up to you and say, you know what? That was harder than I thought it was going to be. I really just need someone to hold space for me right now. Okay, no problem. Where I think prior to that, and my own experience having worked in, you know, film and documentaries where there has been heavy content, we often don't think about being able to reach out to someone because we're so worried that, you know, a director or someone will see us as being not competent in our work, which I think is really where we need to start changing that narrative. And I think it would be great for production companies and even acting coaches to start recognizing that, listen, you know, I'm not a therapist. I can give you all the skills and tools and help you with your craft. But when it comes to these type of really intense scenes, this is not my role or the hat that I should wear. And yes, there are sometimes. I mean, if we are looking at people like Robin Williams, Heath Ledger, there's been many actors out there who are amazing at their craft, but we're still struggling with that mental health because they had to keep face. And I think that that's the biggest thing. It's really kind of destigmatizing the conversation.
You know, we are churning out content at an unprecedented rate with all of these streaming services out there. I mean, there is just new content being pushed out all the time. So how do you see your role or this particular role evolving?
I think one, it's about really getting getting production teams on board to know that this role even exists and why it's important. And I think secondly, the bigger part is people trying to figure out, how do we do it? How do we budget it into the proposal? And how do we make sure that we're finding the right people to do this work? You know, can it just be somebody who only does narrative therapy and isn't, nuanced in somatic therapy? Do we need someone who is trauma informed, or do we need someone who is trauma certified, which are two completely different things? And that is a really important piece because anyone can be trauma informed if they've taken an hour trauma workshop. Being certified in working with somatic therapy that is trauma based and through a trauma lens is a very different thing and takes a lot more schooling to get through. And when you have crisis on set, which sometimes can happen, you have a very short period of time for processing somebody through that and getting them back into what they're doing. So yeah, it's I think it's going to take some time, but I'm hoping that more people will want these conversations and that it'll catch on. And I really just think, you know, people reaching out to me or to others to find out how we did the work, and just, you know, negotiating, collaborating, and building something together is a key essential piece.
Well, we have about a minute left. And you know, if somebody's listening who would like to maybe pursue this and you know, get into this career for themselves, any suggestions on what they should do? I'm going to assume, you know, psychology or would be the first step.
Yeah. So, you know, attending a college or a university and then doing that extra work to become trauma certified as an integrated clinician is really important. But also having a good understanding of the film industry is also really important. You know, I did campaigns for Ronald McDonald House, and they have access to some of the most phenomenal minds in regards to psychology. But it was one of those things that having that acting background was really helpful for the production team.
All right. Incredible. I want people to be able to keep up with you. I'm just fascinated with this role, and I think it is going to be something we're going to hear a lot more about in the future. So where can people follow along with you and your story?
You can always find me on Instagram at Nadia George Official. And you can always go to my website, nadiageorge.com. All of my social media links are there, along with a lot of the information that people might be seeking in how to start, you know, connecting with me, or even if they are looking for referrals for something that I don't necessarily do, I'm always happy to do that as well. So they can contact me through both those platforms.
All right. Wonderful. Nadia, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
As we step into the new year, it's the perfect time to talk about resolutions, specifically dental health resolutions. Today, we're joined again by Dr. Mandeep Johal for our Smile Spectrum segment. And we're not just talking about the usual brushing and flossing, we're diving into how dental health ties into our overall well-being, exploring cosmetic dentistry options, and even how our dental health can impact our posture and gym routines. Let's kickstart the new year with a dazzling dental routine. Welcome, Dr. Johal.
Happy New Year, Candace, and thank you for having me again.
So as we've made our New Year's resolutions, why is it important to include dental health, and how does it connect to our overall well-being?
Well, one thing is just coming off from the holidays, we've pretty much lost our dental routine for most of us. So just kind of getting back onto that, getting our gums and our teeth back into shape. But really, it's just the basic stuff, right? But I really do want to dive into the other stuff that you had touched, because that's something that we don't really talk about. But just get back into it, make sure dental appointments are made so we can maintain better oral health.
Well, let's get into the big one, because I think a lot of people listening, a lot of women specifically, cosmetic dentistry is often sought for a fresh start. So can you discuss some traditional options and perhaps some unique approaches that people might not be aware of?
Yeah, well, like from a holistic, more natural point, I always like something that's a little bit more non-invasive first. So I always say start with a dental cleaning, or start with even something if you don't like your teeth are, you know, maybe misaligned, you have a little bit of crowding, start with even clear liners because they're not invasive. It's very simple and easy to do. Even teeth whitening is a great option. But there's also another option that's very minimally invasive, which is like minimal prep veneers. That means that your dentist will just maybe remove just a little bit of enamel and then be able to put these nice little thin porcelain caps over them to give you like that nice straight teeth or different change of color that you may be looking for. So it's not an option for everybody, but I would always definitely try to see if we can do that. Another thing that we do for patients that's minimally invasive is we do what's called a composite veneers, which is just the regular white filling that you use. And we can just build up your teeth, different colors and shapes, which is something so simple and very non-invasive. And then you have the other ones where people want like full veneers, where they might have to really prep the teeth, or full crowns you might have heard of, where they really shave down the teeth. And I don't really advise it unless it's really needed. I would try everything else before you go to something that really shaves down your teeth, right? You can't get that back.
Yeah. And so for people who've maybe lost some enamel, a veneer would be very helpful.
Yeah, like we're talking about just the front teeth for sure. Like we could do that for the front teeth.
Okay. So many of us who start the gym, obviously, many of us hit the gym as part of our New Year's resolutions. So how does our dental health, particularly when it comes to our posture, you often bring things that I think are not related, but I'm sure you're going to explain. So how is this all related
with gym injuries.
I know. So, okay. So new year and everybody's put on a little extra weight. And the first thing we'll do is like, well, I'll just jump right and go straight to the gym to start losing that few extra pounds you want to lose. But what ends up happening is we have malocclusion, meaning our bite isn't in the right place or our jaw isn't in the right place. And you go lift, start lifting the heavy weight, or you start running for long periods of time, you start putting a lot of strain on your neck and your back. And next thing you know, you've pulled your back or you pulled your knee or you pulled something in your shoulder. But having proper posture, which an airway or a dentist can help you with, will help alleviate that. Like I have so many testimonials now and patients that attest to it that they can actually lift heavier weights with a positional appliance that I can give them. And they're like, how is this possible? I'm like, it is. Your body has more strength when it's in the correct posture. As opposed to having, like, if you had like a jaw that's further back or your teeth are kind of like on a slant like this, that's called malocclusion. That puts a lot of pressure on jaw joint, and it also causes what's called forward head posture, right? So forward head posture, you're going to be prone to some type of injury for sure. So yeah, talk to your functional dentist about what they can do to help you. A simple little appliance can change you so much and prevent those injuries.
And you've mentioned nasal breathing as a unique approach in cosmetic dentistry for anti-aging, which I am particularly interested in. So fill me in, sister.
So we all want to slow how we age, right? So the more mouth breathing we do, and they've done numerous studies, okay? They've done numerous studies where they've literally taken monkeys and they blocked their nasal passages. And just in a short span, they've seen huge changes in their faces. So think about us as humans, especially adults. We see it in children all the time, but even for grown adults, it's going to change the way our face is aging because mouth breathing literally changes our actual physical structure. So you can get fillers and Botox, you know, to kind of do the padding. But what I'm trying to do is help you change and or even maintain the structure that you already have, like the high cheekbones or the upper lip support. So you don't need, people are getting like lip lifts done and fillers in their cheeks. But if you have the bony structure underneath to support it, you might not need it as frequently, or you may not need it as early as you think you would. So yeah, I'm a big component of nasal breathing, starting with babies to children. It literally changes your face. It's changed my face, the way my tongue works. My swallows completely change, even helping with double chins. That's a big thing for a lot of women. They struggle with the turkey neck and the double chin. But I do have lots of stuff on my Instagram, and I have a reel that shows my changes from where my jaw used to be further back 13 years ago. And then just recently, I did my treatment to bring this jaw forward and help eliminate the double chin. I didn't really have a double chin 13 years ago, but you could start seeing that it would have led to that because the chin and the jaw were so further back, like we're pretty retreated further back. And by bringing the lower jaw forward and toning the base, getting the tongue on the roof of the mouth and nasal breathing has completely changed my face.
Well, me and my double chins, thank you for this information. But I'm grateful to know that there is hope out there for me, particularly as I've been aging. I keep thinking, where is this chin coming from? I wish it would just leave me alone.
It's all posture and get that tongue on the roof of the mouth. And you know what? The other thing is really going to help you with nasal breathing and tongue posture is going to be sleep. So the older we're getting, right? Now, getting off the holidays from the lack of sleep and all the alcohol, when we hit that certain age, our body doesn't rebound or lose weight the way it used to in its early 30s or 20s. Getting that sleep, optimizing that nasal breathing is going to help you shed that weight so much quicker, right? So, I mean, I hope this was helpful because it's helped and changed my life and many of my patients' lives.
Absolutely. Amazing, solid information as usual. Where can people keep up with you and connect with you?
My Instagram is actually great. It's wealth of information. It's Dr. Mandeep Johal. And yeah, you guys can DM me, but there's just so much information on there about nasal breathing, sleep, hormones, vitamin D3. That's all plays a role in. So lots of good stuff to help you start the new year right.
Incredible. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
In today's final interview, I'm happy to introduce a truly special guest, Michelle Wang, author of the heartwarming book, Oma's Bag. This beautifully crafted story, which brought tears to my eyes immediately, tenderly addresses the sensitive subject of Alzheimer's in a way that resonates with both children and adults. It's a tale of love, memory, and the unbreakable bond between generations. So let's dive into this poignant narrative and learn more about the inspiration behind it. Welcome to What She Said, Michelle.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
What inspired you to write Oma's Bag, and how did you approach such a complex topic for such a young audience?
Inspiration behind the book is my actual life. The characters in the story are my family. And I started this project as just a present to my family because it was an experience that we were going through. My mother-in-law was diagnosed with Alzheimer's dementia a few years ago. And they normally live in Vancouver, and they often come and visit. And our visits are always lots of fun. They bring lots of presents. She cooks for us, and it's the kids love having her around. The last few visits, we started noticing changes in her behavior. And the very last visit that happened right before I wrote this book was the most significant, where we were noticing that she was forgetting things. She was repeating answers to questions that she asked over and over again. She loved to cook for my kids, as I said, and her cooking started tasting different because we noticed that her fishbowl soup was having many, many portions of salt being added as she was cooking. We were finding things disappearing around the house and finding them in her bag. So we were noticing that she was a little bit different from what we had known her to be in the past. And so for me, I watched my family adapt to this very, very smoothly, though. It was as if she was the same person, but just acting a little differently. And we would find delight in looking in her bag going, oh my gosh. And we called her Mott. So why is this in your bag? And we were laughing, and it was not a sad or accusatory, but it was a fun moment for us. The more poignant part of it was one morning, his dad and I were having breakfast with her, and she was going around asking the same questions, asking us, let's go, let's go, let's go. And he just looked at me and said, I feel like she's slipping away. And at the time, I really had no answer for him because I felt the same way. But in my mind, I was thinking, well, she is not the same person that we've known, but she's still there. She's different. But all her memories, and I think that's a lot of the things that she has in her bag, they all had stories to them. And she's still there. She's collecting them, and we have those. And eventually, you know, she will always be in our hearts. So that was sort of my thought process as I was going through my answer to him, that I'm sure it was a terrible answer that I blurted out to him at the moment. And I had been writing books in the past, and it just seemed to me like it was such a nice story that could be shared, and I thought, just with my family. And then when it was finally written, it seemed like this is probably something that a lot of other families may be going through and could have some value to.
Absolutely. And can you share some insights into sort of the creative process behind the illustrations, which are just beautiful in the book?
I was so lucky to have found my illustrator, Sam Nunez. I have some self-published books that had a wonderful illustrator as well, who lived in Ukraine. And I was hoping for this book to find someone who was more local. And it was actually my sister's, I guess my nephew's classmate, who had just graduated from Sheridan College and was not working in his field. And I just sort of reached out to him and said, would you be interested in trying to illustrate children's books? And he's like, I've always wanted to do that. So we met up in the Peterborough Library, and I showed him my manuscript, and I said, these are some of my ideas. Here's a picture of my family. This is for my family. So do you think you could? And he was sketching it out, and I could not ask for someone who captured the essence of my family better, both physically and emotionally. And he had some ideas of how he thought, and I had some ideas of how I thought pages would look, and it just came together seamlessly. We had lots of back and forth. We were like, what if you added this? Or he said, how about if we've added this? And it was just, what you see in front of you is just an amazing project that I could have done without him. So,
well, I have to say, I was moved to tears reading it. It is such a beautiful book. And I am not dealing with Alzheimer's in my life in any way, shape, or form. So I can't imagine what an impactful tool this would be for families who are, for helping them, you know, with understanding and empathy and connection as it relates to Alzheimer's. So I want them to be able to find you and find the book. Where can they do that?
Well, my publisher is Arsenal Pulp Press. They have it on pre-order for right now on their site. I believe they put it on Amazon as well. For me personally, I have a website, itmustbebooks.com, and Instagram would be itmustbebooks, and Facebook is mustbebooks.
I'm going to put all the links for this on the website when this goes live on podcast so people can find the book and connect with you. Michelle, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
That's it for What She Said this week. Stay up to date with my newsletter by signing up at whatshesaidtalk.com and be sure to follow on social at What She Said Talk on Facebook, Instagram, and X for videos of these interviews and more. You can also catch me on TikTok and Threads at Candace Said. Finally, be sure to subscribe to What She Said with Candace Sampson wherever you listen to podcasts to catch past episodes and extended interviews. I'll be back next week with more What She Said.
What happens when we play outside? We become healthier, both mentally and physically. We become more creative and more focused. We connect with nature, each other, and ourselves. Let's Take This Outside, a new podcast hosted by me, Marianne Iveson, an aspiring outdoor athlete and nature lover. I speak to athletes, outdoor professionals, and scientists about their connection to nature, how it affects their performance and everyday life. Let's Take This Outside, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, and at letstakethisoutside.ca.
I'm Jeff Woods, and I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people. He stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all had.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, you know. And he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.